You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on February 24th, 2014 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Just ahead, guest co-hosts Greg and Nate join me to talk about the political scandal at PBS and about Arizona's new anti-gay legislation. That's coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again, same crew as last week in the studio in Massachusetts, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
On the line from Maryland is Greg.
Hi, everyone.
We've got a whole raft of potential topics to cover this week. People are probably expecting us to talk about what's going on in Ukraine, possibly in Venezuela. Things are moving way too fast on the ground so that by the time this actually gets on the internet or on the air in Delaware, that would be irrelevant, out-of-date information, so I'm just going to direct you to news.google.com. Probably have some analysis later in the week up on the blog. So what we are going to be talking about today is the PBS scandal that I covered on the blog a little bit around the time we did the last week's episode, but we couldn't fit it into last week's episode. This is a bit of a corruption scandal, actually, something that's fit into a broader trend at PBS. Essentially, since the Bush administration, they had been trying to push a lot more conservative content or getting matching up conservative donors with PBS, but that was mostly, you know, going in one direction, and they don't necessarily have editorial control. So, you know, we've known for a while that, for example, the Koch brothers, or at least David Koch, has been, you know, a big financial contributor to NOVA, right, which is a scientific program. He owns an oil company and funds a lot of anti-climate change related political projects around the country. So potential conflict of interest there, right? But he doesn't have editorial control. It says very clearly that it's sponsored by him. Anybody who's curious can look up to see who that is. This is a different case. This is a case where PBS, or at least the officials at WNET, one of their major stations, I think it's one of the ones in Washington, D.C., if I remember correctly.
Newark, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. So they went out of their way to get money from a conservative donor explicitly for the purpose of doing a program that advocated the same thing that he advocates in the political sphere. And they were doing it in such a way that it was presented as balanced news and all that, when in fact it was not. And to cap it off, they gave the foundation giving the money some amount of editorial control, which is against PBS rules. So the story was broken by David Sirota. He said that the PBS officials allegedly solicited $3.5 million from the Laura and John Arnold Foundation. They wanted to make a 2-year series. The project was going to be about not just about public pensions, you know, retirement benefits for public government workers in local and state jurisdictions, but specifically about cutting them and editorially the need to cut them. And I use need in quotes, I think I did in the article as well. They literally called the series Pension Peril, implying that there's a definite danger. And then they repeatedly say throughout the show that these governments need to cut pensions. And, you know, that's not totally out of the mainstream for PBS to be saying. A lot of mainstream media, you know, New York Times or whatever, also making the arguments that, oh, these governments aren't doing enough to cut back on their pension obligations. And it's probably true in some respects that pension obligations back several decades ago were maybe made a little bit more generous than were sustainable in to some degree, but that's not really the full picture. And also, it's very puzzling that in this country we've arrived at a situation where the contract law is supposed to be paramount, But when, you know, a city or jurisdiction files for bankruptcy or something, or even a company files for bankruptcy, the first thing the judge does is break up the pension obligations that are contractually made with the union workers and saying that they are not going to get the benefits that they were promised. And that's not just for new workers. It would be one thing if you had the, you know, governments or companies saying for new workers that they couldn't get these generous benefits. That's fine. You're giving them a new contract. But this is for the old workers who were already promised certain benefits. And so they say these contracts are now invalid and you're going to get paid less than you were previously promised. And this is supposedly a very urgent need. Of course, as Sirota points out, and many others have pointed out, in many cases, these governments are actually spending a lot of discretionary spending, meaning spending that they can choose whether or not to cut or continue. They're spending more on those things than they are on these pension obligations, emphasis on the word obligation, that they had promised to pay. So the issue here is that you know, there isn't actually in many cases as great or even a need at all in some cases for making these cuts. And it certainly shouldn't be the first thing cut. You know, these corporate subsidies, we can talk about that in a second, would be an example of ways that governments could save money before they go after their public pension workers. So that's kind of the situation that the show was purporting to report on. Then it's sketchy enough that they go and ask for $3.5 million from this foundation, but they also said that the foundation would still have the right to cut the funding at will for any time, you know, under extreme circumstances, which is not something that they gave other foundations or typically give, because that is against the rules at PBS. And in one episode, they even not only praised the efforts of various anti-pension activists, but they were promoting and pumping up this ballot initiative being proposed in California. The main backer of this was John Arnold himself. He's a huge financial donor to these anti-pension or pension breaking causes all over the country. And so that was kind of the situation. They did return the money after this report came out, which is, I would say, a pretty big admission, but the series still continues.
In one episode of these pension peril episodes, they sort of profiled a bankruptcy of the town of Vallejo in California, and from the looks of it, they sort of just throw in very, very quickly the reference that this town lost a shipyard, and that was one of the largest employers in town, and that, you know, seems to be the bulk of the responsibility for this bankruptcy, not necessarily, you know, sky-high pensions. So, you know, you sort of just look at it and think, well, are they really trying to tell the accurate story of what's going on here, or are they just trying to drive home a political point, and that's clearly what they're doing.
Right. And this has been a common theme that we've talked about on this show so many times, this idea of talking about, oh, that we have to cut spending, we have to cut these benefits programs, we have to cut all these things, without looking at the fact that there are both short and long-term revenue things to consider, right? So you have the long-term revenue side, which is, are these going to be sustainable in the long run? Are we going to come up with the money for them? And then there's the short-term ones, like we've seen with the federal budget stuff, that you say, yeah, guess what? The recession causes the revenue to go down. So when the recession is over and the recovery is back up, revenues will go back up and the deficit will not entirely close itself, but will go a long way toward closing itself. And the debt to GDP ratio, much trumpeted about by the proponents of cutting the spending, that's going to adjust itself as well too, because the GDP side of that ratio will go up as well as the debt situation going down because there are higher revenues. So these things don't fix themselves entirely, but a lot of them in the short term can be resolved by, you know, economic stimulative efforts rather than pulling money out of the economy and breaking contracts. Greg, I want to get you in on this story now.
Sure. I also thought that the juxtaposition of PBS's behavior in this instance versus PBS's behavior in 2013. I don't know if some of you were aware of, I'm sure Nate was, Nate and I are the sports guys. The PBS had a partnership with ESPN and they did a documentary called League of Denial, and that was about the NFL and its efforts to either suppress or remain intentionally ignorant of the dangers, especially the brain injury dangers of the NFL and football in general. And the big thing that came out about that was that ESPN, in partnership with PBS, was pressured allegedly from the NFL and actually pulled out of the documentary series because the NFL wanted to have more editorial control over the documentary. And obviously ESPN and NFL are very closely aligned economically. ESPN has a bunch of ESPN, ABC, Disney have a bunch of different contracts with the NFL. And the juxtaposition here is that everyone applauded what PBS was doing there, which is basically, oh, they have editorial integrity. They're not like ESPN, ABC, Disney in that they're being pressured by the NFL because they don't have this economic relationship, blah, blah, blah. And I just thought it was interesting here that, you know, we're talking 6 months later, this might even be a more egregious thing. And so we were so quick to pat them on the back, and yet here we are.
A couple other things I'd also add is, first of all, the League of Denial documentary is excellent. There's a lot of really great interviews with neurosurgeons and people that have studied this sort of issue for a long time, examining all sorts of dead bodies and brains. But aside from that, a couple other things about Arnold. Apparently he pled the fifth when asked by Dianne Feinstein or in a deposition at some point whether, as a part of Enron, he manipulated California energy markets. So that's good to know. Had a large part on that. One other thing about PBS is they recently canceled a documentary that they were doing about, or by Alex Gibney, who's a Academy Award winning documentary filmmaker. It was about a building in Manhattan, I believe, where the Koch brothers have some offices, and sort of focused on them a little bit, and that was pulled. And, you know, connect the dots if you will, how much of the level did the Koch brothers have sort of influence on that in PBS? But, you know, this is not, I guess, the first time that PBS has sort of monkeyed around with their editorial integrity. So that's, you know, pretty worrying.
Right. And I would say that it's fair. I think we all agree probably that it's fair to, you know, for PBS to have opinion oriented shows sometimes, like they, Sirota cites the show POV, which literally has point of view in the name, right? And but those aren't marketed as, this is the fine, you know, journalistic integrity and objectivity that you've come to rely on from PBS, you know, that's not the fluffy, you know, fake journalism from the other, you know, commercial networks and stuff like that. You know, that's where you start running into trouble. And they were pitching this show as this objective, fact-based thing, while then literally promoting initiatives that were being financed by the guy who was paying for the show. And he didn't even approach them.
Yeah, I thought that was probably the grossest thing when I read that. It's just that they weren't bribed. They weren't bribed, but they solicited a bribe. So they, I guess, had an idea for a documentary series about pensions, and then somebody must have brainstormed, oh, hey, there's this Laura and John Arnold Foundation, and they are ideologically supporters of what our thesis would be for this documentary series. Go and see if we can get any money from them. And so that's the thing that I found really problematic. I feel with other commercial stations, there are lines drawn. They're increasingly becoming blurred, but there are still lines drawn from when this is the program and then this is the commercial. This is the advertisement, because, you know, there's always a we'll be right back from commercial break or whatever. But increasingly that advertisement is seeping into, you know, the actual programming. PBS doesn't have commercials. So PBS is funded through the government, and PBS is also funded through private donations. And so they don't have all the commercial revenue that a lot of other companies or broadcasting networks have. So the thing here is that they're, again, like Bill said, purporting to be this subjective analysis, and yet there is almost complete seepage from the advertisement and commercial aspect to and into the journalistic aspect of what they made through this documentary with Pension Peril.
Right. And I think that's an interesting point that I hadn't even really considered before, which is, you know, if you watch a commercial thing, well, A, you know it's commercial, right? And then you see an advertisement for, say, Coca-Cola or something, right? And then you see Coca-Cola products in the show. Or I know, like, Microsoft has been doing a ton of product placement, so you'll see Microsoft Surfaces, you know, being used in the episodes, the drama or the comedy or whatever that you're watching. But you kind of know, you're like, okay, this is clearly an embedded advertisement being shown at me, right? But if you hear the, you know, know, so-and-so and so-and-so foundation, that doesn't really mean anything, right? That's pretty oblique. Right. That's not a commercial saying this is what we believe in. This show is brought to you by a chemical company and is pro-chemicals or whatever. You can do the math on that, but if you just hear this generic foundation named for someone, you have no way of knowing, and they're not going to show you an advertisement like, you know, I'm John Arnold, and I support cutting pensions, and I approve this message and this program or whatever, right? Like, they don't have something like that. So yeah, I think that does become a little bit trickier. Although, you know, as Sirota notes, this is coming in a larger context at PBS. I remember seeing this happen during the Bush administration. Over time, those like underwriter pitch things at the beginning and ends of shows started getting more elaborate and more like commercials, and started, you know, telling you more about the things that they do, or they'd give you the tagline of, I don't know, Procter & Gamble's Johnson & Johnson division or something like that, right? You know, they were getting a little bit more overt with it, and this was part of the government trying to get, you know, more private funding for these programs and less government funding, even though, of course, this is one of the many liberal domestic policy items passed by the raging commies over in the Nixon administration, you know, when he was pushed by folks like Mr. Rogers. But so this is, you know, this is a broader pattern that's been happening there, and very troubling, I think, for the content direction of PBS. The only other thing I really wanted to touch on before we close out this segment is just this notion that I alluded to earlier, which is, you know, we've got to start thinking very seriously about some of these things that aren't exactly expenditures. They're what's known as tax expenditures, which is essentially a very fancy way of saying a tax cut. Sometimes they're actual subsidies, but you know, why are you, you know, someone did work for you as an employee and was promised certain benefits when they retired. Okay. And you promised that. Why are you trying to take that back now in comparison to giving out billions and billions of dollars? The example that Sirota gave was the city of Chicago, for example, giving out far more in these corporate tax breaks and subsidies than they are paying out in pensions. But this doesn't come up in the discussion. And a tax break is a tax expenditure. It's a loss of revenue, and therefore, you know, is equivalent to spending that amount of money. And so it's, you know, something that we've got to consider pretty seriously. You know, this is a topic that's come up in here in Newton, Massachusetts, where Nate and I are recording the show, this issue of the company that many people have heard of, TripAdvisor, which is actually based here, or was based here, and they moved to the next town over in Needham, Massachusetts, right? And the reason for that was competitive corporate incentives and stuff like that. And there is definitely a role to be played for some sort of corporate incentives, things that help fit the right company to the right workforce and things like that. But you do have a lot of these states and local governments in this race to the bottom of, well, this company would probably locate here anyway, but we're going to give them this big cushy deal. Or as the former governor of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm, argued in her book, these states actively going out and trying to compete for jobs and companies against each other, which just screws over everyone and reduces everyone's budgets and the governmental level. And these are things that are optional, right? They're things that the governments could cut back on. I'm sure that they're going to try to argue they can't, but in terms of budgeting, those are things that are optional. Paying out pension obligations theoretically is not optional. So we should be talking about those discretionary things first before we start talking about breaking contracts.
I would also just say that I hope nothing happens to compromise the integrity of the Frontline series, which I think is one of the best documentary TV series out there. They were the ones that did League of Denial and a variety of all sorts of different really interesting documentaries. You know, we really need to protect this kind of programming. So, you know, you got to hope that they've sort of learned their lesson from these couple instances, and, you know, they gave back the money. So, you know, we can hope that in the future they're not accepting giant bribes, basically, from conservative donors.
Or any donors, for that matter.
Yeah, not just conservative.
So, I think that's a very good point. And I think that as consumers of television media, there has to be at least some sort of trust and between the broadcasting company and consumers. And I think that consumers are savvy enough, especially for being able to tell what is a commercial, what is product placement. But this stuff that's long form, or at least appears to be long form journalism, that I feel like sort of breaks the trust that we have become so reliant upon as consumers, especially from organizations like PBS that gave us, like Bill said earlier, Mr. Rogers is probably like the greatest human being that ever walked the face of the earth. That's hyperbolic, but you get the idea, is that like they have built up this cachet of trust, and then in the past 10 years or so, they've have had numerous instances where they've betrayed that trust, and it's very problematic.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. We will be back in just a moment after a quick break. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me this week is Nate. On the line from Maryland is Greg. Our next topic is from the state of Arizona. If you've been paying attention to the U.S. news for the past week, you know what this topic is going to be about. SB 1062, which has been, you know, probably dubbed by the opponents as the right to discriminate bill. This is a legislation that is, it happens to be that it's just been passed by Arizona. Kansas was trying to push through an effort recently. We're going to talk about this. This is part of a broader effort. This is not in any way limited to Arizona. So despite all of the, you know, criticism that we might want to throw at the state of Arizona for many of the things that they deserve criticism for, this is something to criticize them for, but not because of them being Arizona inherently, because other states are doing this too. And that's something that I feel has been kind of left out a bit from the discussion. But essentially, the idea here is that private business owners who have like a restaurant or a photography studio or a catering business, something like that, if they have deeply held religious convictions personally, not at all a religious business or organization. They're not, you know, a Catholic hospital or something, right? They're not a Catholic charity or any of those kind of things. They're just a person with religious views who owns a business. This bill would give them the right, and it's been passed by the Senate and the House and is waiting the governor's decision. It would give them the right to refuse service. Now, this attacks a core tenet of a principle that was established during the 1960s civil rights movement, 1950s, 1960s, which was, of course, a race-focused struggle there. But the idea there was that you could not, if you were providing, even if you were not the government yourself, you could not discriminate against people based on race as a business owner if you were providing a public service, essentially, or a public accommodation. So, you know, you couldn't ban black people from eating at your restaurant. You couldn't ban black people from staying at your hotel, so on and so forth. Now, some states interpreted their laws such that, you know, this automatically included gay people later. But, you know, in large part, that wasn't even an issue for a long time because until people started coming out and being in couples and getting services that were specifically related to the fact that they were gay, as opposed to just being a gay person who happened to go, you know, want to get burgers or something, right? This didn't become an issue for a while. Then it became a dispute and they said, okay, well, we're, you know, are people allowed to discriminate based on sexual orientation and religious beliefs surrounding those orientations? And most states said, no, you can't do that. And it took them a while in a lot of states to pass special protections. Some states just kind of adopted it in under the other principles if they were broad enough, but essentially saying, look, you can't, if you're providing a public service, you can't discriminate against somebody based on, you know, your personal religious beliefs. You shouldn't be in the business if you can't provide services fairly to everyone. Now, unlike with the issue of race, you cannot always necessarily tell, like looking at someone, that they're gay, right? So the business owners tend to be discriminating in specific situations like providing services to couples as a couple or, you know, marriage, wedding related services, things like that. Now, when I was working on the marriage equality campaign in Delaware last year, this is something that came up in the testimony a lot, saying, oh, we shouldn't pass marriage equality laws, even though civil unions were already legal, on the grounds that this would encourage more situations where people would be put into conflict between their trying to provide, you know, run a business, but their personal religious opposition to these couples getting married or being in relationships. Now, it was already on the books in Delaware that you couldn't discriminate against this, so that was kind of irrelevant, actually. And civil unions, of course, were already in place, so couples were already trying to get these services, photographers, catering, flower shop, things like that. But in most cases, there are plenty of other options. You can go to somewhere else, but the idea is that you shouldn't be able to just discriminate against someone based on your religious beliefs, especially when it's entirely irrelevant to your business and the service that you're providing. And, you know, LGBTQ people have been discriminated against for quite some time, and it's not really fair. And that's why there's, you know, they get protected class status in most of these court decisions upholding these discrimination cases when those laws exist. But in most cases, again, in a lot of states, they already exist, which is why there's been this big push to try to roll that back. The main lawyer who was testifying against the marriage equality bill, and I believe was also testifying against the civil unions bill in Delaware, was this guy from ADF, the I guess it used to be called the Alliance Defense Fund. They used to fund lawyers, conservative, Christian conservative lawyers or Mormon lawyers who were going into legislatures and working on or helping people who said that they had their rights had been violated because they weren't allowed to discriminate. And they would, you know, be paying out. They changed their name now to the Alliance Defending Freedom, even more euphemistic. But anyway, this is the same group that's been pushing the legislation in Arizona. They were the group that backed the legislation. I mean, backed this lawsuit fight in New Mexico that triggered this, which was a photography studio did not want to provide services to a lesbian couple's commitment ceremony. It wasn't even a marriage. And they had been, I think, providing services, or there was a similar case in Oregon maybe, that where they would provide services for a while, and then they realized, oh, you're a couple, I don't support that, and then they would try to cut off services. And, you know, you can say, oh, well, why didn't the couple just go to some other business? But it shouldn't really work like that, right? People shouldn't be able to just enforce their beliefs in that manner when you're providing a public service. If you set up shop taking advantage of all the other, you know, public features and the town development and this, you know, everything that's gone into making it possible for you to have a vibrant business, you shouldn't be providing a public service, but only to some people, because where does that line get drawn? And back in the 60s, people were making the argument that you know, there was a moral difference, a moral superiority, you know, of whites compared to people who were of color, and that justified the different treatment. Now, of course, the revisionist history says, oh, well, there's clearly that was immoral and there was no, you know, to discriminate and that there was no justification for that or whatever, but here it's different. And the fact is, people have always used religion or whatever other personal belief to try to discriminate against other people. And that's not okay. And you cannot be opening up a business and providing services, but then only providing it to some people based on their identity, something about them that they didn't have any control over, right? As Nate and I think we were discussing before we started recording, you can refuse service to someone because they're terrible and disruptive or whatever, you know, causing a scene. You can ban someone from your restaurant for something like that, but that's something that they have control over, right? This is not part of their identity. It's not their race. It's not their orientation. And in many cases, you know, that they're saying, okay, well, we want them to be able to discriminate because we don't approve of the lifestyle, quote unquote. Well, first of all, it's pretty offensive to phrase it like that. But second of all, it doesn't have to do with anything these people do. Whether, even if they've never had a relationship of any kind or anything like that, doesn't change whether or not someone is gay. So you are discriminating against them fundamentally as a person. It's kind of weird to be focusing on the quote-unquote lifestyle aspect, because you don't ever focus on that with regard to heterosexual people, let alone people in couples, right? So it's entirely composed of straw arguments, and there's no justification for being able to do this. But in response to these mounting cases, the groups like the ADF have been pushing these bills in Kansas, in Arizona, in a whole range of other states, trying to roll back the progress that's already been made on protections for LGBTQ people, because they want business owners to be able to refuse service to gay and lesbian people and other people under the umbrella of gender and sexual minorities. This is a very serious trend that we're looking at. There's nothing justifying it. It's purely malice, and your personal belief shouldn't have to do with whether or not you serve bagels to gay people or whatever. So, you know, there's no real justification here.
Yeah, I'm just reading here one quote from one governor, Jan Brewer, who we all know and love. And she's talking about how, you know, she needs to study this bill a little more. She knows it's controversial. She says, I think that anyone who owns a business can choose who they work with or who they don't work with. But I don't know it needs to be statutory. In my life and business, if I don't want to do business or if I don't want to deal with a particular company or person or whatever, I'm not interested. That's America. That's freedom. And, I mean, that's a great point of view. I mean, just, you know, you have your religion, and if your religion says you don't want to deal with gays or with Asians or people that have mohawks or people whose shoes you don't like, then, hey, don't deal with them. I mean, that's America. That's freedom, I guess. So I just, it's pretty frustrating because I don't think these people can really see the parallels that they're really, really dealing with here. It's a little frustrating.
Right. Now, if you look at the actual text, I looked at the summary text on the Arizona legislature website. The way that they've framed this, and there's 2 points that we're going to get to, but I want to get to just one of them right now. The way that they've framed this is that it changes it so that if there's a suit, right, a lawsuit that comes up, the government doesn't have to be involved in this, right? So the way that it has worked under the current system is that a gay or lesbian couple, for example, having been denied service, could file a discrimination suit against the other people, right? But the business owners cannot sue back. The way that this works is essentially changing it so that they can say that their rights have been violated by the couple that they don't like, essentially, if I'm understanding this correctly, which I believe is roughly what's being argued here. Because typically your so-called, and this is another common theme on the show here, your First Amendment, freedom of religion, freedom of expression, freedom of speech rights are those freedoms
better than other freedoms.
Well, but basically the idea being that those are freedoms from government interference, right? So the issue is, the government is not oppressing your right. Although that's what they're alleging anyway, is that the government's oppressing their right by having these anti-discrimination laws in place. But the way that this works is that they're now saying, now you have a First Amendment right to practice your religion and say whatever you want to anybody without any consequences. And this is something, you know, and you can go and look at my post when the Duck Dynasty thing came up or whatever. This is something that comes up all the time. Yes, you have the right to express yourself and have, you know, your freedom of religion and your freedom of speech and everything. If you're not endangering anyone, good for you. That's the way the United States works. The government can't take that away from you. But other people more or less can take it away from you. Not in the sense that they can, you know, necessarily like, you know, hurt you or anything. That's the way that the Westboro Baptist Church has essentially been able to, you know, make its money, is they just, if anyone tries to actually interfere with their protests, then they just sue those people for, you know, interfering, and then the government for not protecting their freedom of speech rights. But the issue here is not about the government, and they're trying to change it so that you now have a First Amendment right against gay couples that you disagree with their quote unquote lifestyle, because they want to be able to not have any consequences from discriminating. Yeah, it's very American to be able to do whatever you want and associate with whomever you want, but that doesn't mean there aren't consequences for your behavior. When, you know, a network pulls a show from somebody for making, you know, hate speech comments, that's not their First Amendment right being violated. That's the corporation responding to the marketplace of ideas, which has condemned this as an objectionable idea. And anyone's free to, you know, to say anything that they want, but everyone else, except for the government, is free to respond to that and shout them down or do whatever. Everyone should just be able to access everything equally, in my opinion. And it's there's no logic behind this in terms of, other than malice, in terms of wanting to discriminate, because it's not really your business if somebody's gay, whether or not they are involved in the quote unquote lifestyle. It's not your business. And if you're going to have a business that serves people, then you got to be prepared to serve everyone, and, you know, not just pick and choose by class. Again, you can pick and choose by individuals, I guess, but not on discriminatory grounds that would affect other people as well.
Yeah, I mean, the author, or one of the attorneys for the authors of this bill, John LaRue, I'm just reading from an LA Times article here, basically gave some sort of analogy that I guess he thinks really proves the need for this bill. He talks about how if the Westboro Baptist Church came down to Arizona and they wanted a cake, you know, with their famous quote, you know, and we have to protect the ability of the bakery to deny them that thing. And I mean, I don't necessarily know the in and outs of New Mexico and Arizona, you know, civil discrimination suits, things like that. But I think it would be pretty easy to say, we're just not going to serve you guys because we don't make cakes with slurs on them. And we don't serve people that are, you know, disruptive protests
right
around. I don't think that's necessarily a religious freedom issue.
Right. And they're not discriminating in that case against the Westboro Baptist Church's religious freedoms. They're just saying these specific people have, you know, tried to ask us to provide an objectionable service that we do not provide, you know, to them specifically. And it's because of the views, I guess. But and I see where they're going with the analogy, but I just don't think it's really appropriate
to say that just being just gay and maybe you're with your partner, maybe you're not with your partner, and you just walk into a store and they could refuse you service and you didn't do anything except be gay. That doesn't, the analogy there that they're saying, oh, the Westboro Baptist Church wouldn't, we need to be able to let the bakery not make a cake that says something objectionable. If somebody from the Westboro Baptist Church came in to the bakery and wanted a plain cupcake, that's fine. And the bakery probably wouldn't object to that. Right. So the analogy here, and I think that it's a spurious one because they don't have a leg to stand on. There is no legitimate argument against this. If you don't want to serve people that are LGBTQ and they sue you in court because of that, too bad. You shouldn't have protection from that. Why are we going to protect you from being a jerk? I mean, the Constitution does not provide you a right from people reacting to you being a jerk.
Right.
I've never seen that. I don't think that's what the founders intended. I mean, it does protect you from the government taking action against you being a jerk.
Nate, you had some thoughts on this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just really consistently impressed me about how good the Republicans are ever since they took over in 2010 in a lot of these states and in Congress about shooting themselves in the foot on pretty much every single issue. I mean, whether it's women's issues and abortion, I guess with this new gays bill, healthcare, gun control. I mean, it's just one time after the other, like, let's not talk, or immigration, that's a huge one. Let's, you know, not actually seriously address the issues that most American people are concerned about, but let's rail on these sort of culture war type things that really aren't the biggest deals in the world, but they appeal to our base. So let's really get after it, I guess, make that the main focus instead of governing the country. I mean, what are we doing here? Chris Christie, is he going to be the next president? Doesn't look like it. He managed to just completely derail his presidential campaign before it even started. You've got, you know, Marco Rubio backtracking on immigration, really managing to anger the Republican base on that. I mean, it just seems like everywhere you turn, you know, got vaginal ultrasound bills going. It doesn't seem like since 2010, the Republicans have made a serious effort at governing in a lot of these states. It seems more like they sort of play up these wedge issues that maybe were effective in 2004, but really aren't now,
yeah.
And just making themselves a giant distraction.
Well, and it even goes back further than 2010. It goes to the 2010 election, of course, too, because you got Christine O'Donnell, the exemplar of that kind of strategy of shooting yourself. You know, that was supposed to be a sure thing from the Republican point of view, picking up Delaware with Mike Castle in the Senate, and he didn't win the primary, right? And then you got the same year you got Ken Buck, who loses in Colorado to Michael Bennett, who's a nobody, former superintendent of the, okay, he's not a nobody, he's the brother of the editor-in-chief of the Atlantic or something like that. But anyway, you know, was the superintendent of Denver Public Schools or something like that, right? Like, not something that should have positioned him to win the Senate seat, and he wins against Ken Buck, who's now, by the way, running again and still on a very, you know, anti-abortion platform. Ken Buck, as a district attorney, you know, had declined to prosecute a pretty much open and shut rape case where the rapist even admitted that he had had non-consensual sex with someone who was asleep. And Ken Buck said, no, it just seems like, and I quote, buyer's remorse. Okay. And this guy's running again for Senate in Colorado against, you know, Mark Udall, who's reasonably popular, but potentially vulnerable, the incumbent there. And, you know, what are you guys doing? And he beat out in 2010, he beat out for the nomination a relatively moderate but still reasonably conservative Republican woman. I think she was the lieutenant governor or former lieutenant governor of Colorado at the time. Next door, you got Harry Reid's bacon getting saved by crazy Sharon Angle winning, who wanted to, you know, let people barter poultry for health insurance. And, you know, as Nate says, all these other things, you got then in the 2012 cycle, you got the legitimate rape and the you know, the body has ways of shutting it down type comments. I was just re-listening to an episode actually from last March. Let's see, March 2013, in which a frequent co-host and commentator on the show, Sasha, was noting that the personhood amendment put on the ballot in Mississippi on an off-peak special election in Mississippi got shot down by a huge proportion of the voters. And now you've got, you know, she's probably still going to have a very uphill battle, but you've got a potentially credible candidate coming out of Texas now to run for governor solely based on the strength of the Texas Republicans going way, way too far overboard on the anti-abortion pushes, way outside of the mainstream of where the American public is on these issues. And as Nate said, it's you've got the, you know, the they're wrong on the gay issues. They're wrong on the abortion issues. They're wrong on a whole range of things and running on these 2004 social positions.
I mean, also several of the, I think, state representatives who voted for this bill recently said that they regretted that and are now, I guess, telling the governor to veto it, and John McCain's against it, and I guess Jeff Flake, who's relatively conservative. I mean,
Jeff Flake is a very conservative Mormon senator from Arizona, and great. Somehow Jeff Flake is against this as well. To Nate's point, why are they still shooting themselves in the foot? You know, they're clearly outpacing, like, where they're supposed to be.
Do these people want Hillary to be the next president? I mean, I guess that's the only really logical outcome from,
you
these
know, they love to hate
series
her.
Of events. They don't I know mean, I guess else. It would be good business for Fox News.
They don't know anything else. That's what I think is ultimately the driving force in kind of beating the same drum over and over and over again.
And I think, you know, as Nate and I were talking about before the show, that there's this just overwhelming irony here of this idea that these Christians are the persecuted ones rather than clearly being in the dominant position for a long time in this country. And specifically, even the Christian conservatives have been dominant for, you know, a 20-year period or so, 30 years, but, you know, waning influence in some states at this point, but not all states, right? And saying that they're persecuted, which is laughable on its face, and then saying furthermore that they just want to be left alone and they want to have their beliefs respected. Well, I'm sorry, but you live in a multicultural society with a lot of other people who have other beliefs too. And, you know, those people need to, you know, it's a system where everyone's beliefs need to be respected as much as can possibly be accommodated, but sometimes not everyone gets to have their way, at least in terms of state functions and things that happen in the public sphere. You can do whatever you want in your home space, but that's your home space. But then, of course, they want the government to intervene and interfere in other people's homes. So meanwhile, while they are trying to say that they want to be left alone, they're not leaving other people alone. They're trying to actively propagate their belief, which again, when we were talking about evangelical Christians specifically, come on, do not tell me that you want to be left alone when you're an evangelical Christian, because evangelical literally means that you're trying to evangelize and convert people to your religion. Okay, if you had a religion that just left everyone alone and didn't try to convert anyone, then you would be definitely entitled to say that you just wanted to be left alone, right? But you also wouldn't be trying to enact a policy agenda because that's the thing. When you go out in the world outside of the bounds of your own home, you got to live with other people. They don't always share your views. They don't always share the lifestyle that you believe is the morally correct one, and you have to accept that to a certain extent. You don't just get to purge the world to make it, you know, in the image that you think that it should be. That's God's job, not your job.
But Bill, isn't this a Christian nation?
Yeah, it's not a Christian nation. We can go back to some back episodes from my previous radio show, wherein I looked at the number of founding fathers who were members of the Senate when they voted for the Treaty of Tripoli that affirmed that the United States is not and never has been a Christian nation. There were a lot of people who were involved in the Constitution who were still in the Senate at the time when that passed unanimously and was signed by Thomas Jefferson. Then again, Thomas Jefferson got removed from the textbooks in Texas, so I guess he's out. Oh. Greg, did you have any thoughts on the angle here, the Republican angle here?
Well, I mean, I think that going back to what I was kind of interjecting earlier was just basically that they don't know anything else. And what I meant by that was basically that this is a thing that has worked with their base for a really long time. And they're either unwilling to develop a new strategy to either get their base in, to rile up their base in a way that doesn't offend the other base, or to develop a new policy platform that will perhaps encompass more people than they already have, because they're in a demographic death spiral right now. I mean, the demographics are getting, you know, increasingly less white and increasingly
less religious.
Right, less religious. And so I think that, you know, they keep beating the same drum because it's worked previously, but, you know.
Well, and also they believe in it very firmly.
Well, I do agree with that as well, but there's plenty of things that I believe in that I'm not going to go and create an entire platform for, because I knew that it would be alienating to some people and that it's not the hugest deal in the world.
Right.
You know,
it's like how I don't like Wendy Davis's position on gun control, but I do support her position for her campaign for other reasons. Right. You have to be willing to accept that not everyone agrees with you 100% of the time.
Right. Exactly. And so I just feel like they're so afraid to do the research to say what ideas are more palatable to both sides, and we could still hit our core demographic and perhaps maybe, you know, bring some people over to our side. They're so, you know, again, either unwilling or unable to do that, because this is what they've done for so long and it's worked for so long, and now it's not working, but they're not really getting that, and or maybe they are getting that, and that's why they're trying to do all this stuff with, you know, ostensibly voter suppression in the states where, you know, there are a large majority or increasing majority of people that would vote against them if it was easier to vote. So that's the only proactive thing that they've done in terms of you know, sustained party, is making it harder to vote for people that are poor and of color,
and specifically on the gay issue. This did used to be the type of issue that would allow them to sort of go after vulnerable demographics, maybe people in the middle or even some Democrats who weren't totally on board with gay marriage back in 2004. That's really changed now. And, you know, it seems like they're definitely alienating people who might be sympathetic to Republican messages on jobs, on the economy, things like that, taxes, and really turning them off, because they just, at this point, it seems like most people just are tired of this sort of, you know, constant cultural warfare around gays, and especially with the younger generation, it's just not an issue that's on their priority list. And in fact, if you sort of go the other direction, start denying rights to gay people, it's an active negative and really a distraction to issues that where the Republicans could be cleaning up. I mean, it's not like every single person in America loves Obama and loves the Democratic Party. There's definitely some vulnerability there, and this is just not the issue to really exploit that. In fact, it's doing the opposite.
To sort of synthesize the points that I think both of you are making, I think this ties back to the issue that Greg and I discussed in the December bonus episode, which is this idea that this is very similar to the attitude of the opposition in Thailand that's been protesting extensively, which is this idea that they've been out of power since 1992, except when the military intervenes or they're otherwise illegitimately put into power. But in terms of elections, they've been unsuccessful. And their approach is the ruling majority, not in terms of the government, but in terms of the, you know, national voting demographics, the ruling majority voters are ignorant, uneducated, don't deserve to be in power, don't know how to be in power, are being duped by social spending. They're being, you know, it's the same, you're being kept on the plantation by the government or whatever, which is an offensive thing to say in the first place. But, you know, this attitude saying that the only reason that we're losing is because everyone else has been duped by lies and is not educated and not wise enough and doesn't see the light clearly enough. And it's like, no, at a certain point, you have to recognize that the only way you're going to get back into power is by appealing to those people that you've now spent two decades or more offending mortally and, you know, and maligning and all these other things. You've got to broaden your coalition. That's the only thing, once the demographics change against you, that gets you back into power. And you can make a choice. Do you want to be out of power for good? Or do you want to be, you know, or, you know, 20, 30 years? Or do you want to be out of power for 4, 5, 6 years? Right? There's a choice to be made. Now, You know, the other thing, of course, is that we've seen the splintering in the Republican Party of the sort of libertarian side, the big business side, the social conservative side. The social conservatives, of course, and ironically, some of the libertarians kind of controlling a lot of the outcomes on these primaries against the interests of big business. Looks like ALEC, which is very oriented toward the, you know, Citizens United type angle, seems to have been involved or had a hand in potentially this one provision that that this is the second provision in this bill that's ostensibly a socially conservative bill, was expands the definition of person to include any individual, association, partnership, corporation, church, estate, trust, foundation, or other legal entity. So the short version of that expands the definition of person to include corporation. This means that within the state of Arizona, not only are they changing the definition of who is protected by the First Amendment and who you're protected from, but they're changing it to say, literally, corporations are people. And that seems to be the way that they've attempted here to merge the disparate strands of the big business Republicans with the social conservative Republicans.
I think another point that's, I guess, sort of related to all of this is, if you remember back a couple of years ago, how Rand Paul basically said that he didn't believe in the
right
portion of the Civil Rights Act where the government could basically ban businesses from denying black customers services, you know, and he had that sort of huge blow up where he went on Rachel Maddow and, you know, sort of awkwardly tried to defend his views. I mean, this guy could be a candidate for president next year, a serious one, now that Chris Christie is really sort of dropped off the map here because of this whole bridge scandal. You know, maybe he'll still make a good push, but, you know, that remains to be seen. But I think Rand Paul will be a guy in the mix for the Republican presidential nomination. And it sort of just highlights to what the sort of libertarian / Christian conservative stream in the Republican Party has become. I mean, they basically want to roll back some of the provisions of the Civil Rights Act and things related to that in order to create a new world in which they can sort of, you know, discriminate however they please if they don't like someone's beliefs, because their beliefs apparently trump everyone else's, I guess.
Right. He, of course, tries to defend this by saying that, you know, it shouldn't be the role of the government to intervene. It should be the marketplace of ideas or whatever. But then they're not even willing to take the consequences of the marketplace of ideas, shouting you down for having ideas that are not accepted by the rest of society or are seen as dated and inappropriate.
But I also don't think the market would have shut down discrimination.
No, absolutely
in the
not.
South. I mean, a lot of white people who had all the money, they were fine with that. So that's, the market would have supported that.
Right. But this is this constant pitch that said, you know, oh, white people are being discriminated against or Christians are being discriminated against. No, you're not. OK, someone can be a bigot toward you, but that is not the same thing automatically as discrimination. Discrimination involves a power situation where the person in power is using their power against you for something that is part of your identity. Right. So as Nate said, the situation was never going to change in the South without some sort of serious government intervention, at least in the short to midterm, because of the fact that the white people in the South controlled the economic power structure, not just the political power structure. Okay. And that's the idea when you talk about these issues of whether or not people are being persecuted or whether there's reverse racism, a topic that you hear way too much about during Black History Month. There is no reverse discrimination against people who control the political system and the economic structure. It literally defies the definition of what that is. This is a country that still has very strong strands of white supremacist control. They might not be out there in white hoods and saying these things openly, but if you look at the statistics on a whole range of issues, like Greg and I talked a few weeks ago about incarceration of minority youth, things like that, you look at these things, there's a very clear direction of which way things are going. And sorry to break it to you, college students, but, you know, 50 whatever percent of you claiming that you feel that white people are now discriminated against as much as people of color, that's nonsense. This is a structure that is still fundamentally built around white people in a large sense, and specifically is still dominated by Christian conservative-oriented laws, especially in many states in the country, even if it's no longer prevalent in, say, New England or New York or California, right? You are not being discriminated against until you have completely lost power and the other side has then taken power and has started to use the levers of power against you for a sustained period of time. And that's nowhere near the situation that we're at right now. right? I mean, we still have majority status as white people in this country, and that's not going to change for quite some time. The demographics are headed in that direction, but even so, white people will remain a plurality, and then all the systems are set up to keep them in the channels of power and the institutions and organizations of power. This is a country that has not moved beyond a lot of its problems. It's making some progress, but people are trying to, you know, pull up short and say, oh, well, we got a black president, so therefore I'm being discriminated against because there's one person at the tippy top of the pyramid who Congress has proven has very little authority to do anything if they don't want him to, and therefore he does not control the levers of power and cannot therefore discriminate against you, okay? And they're busy still trying to relitigate affirmative action cases and things like that, not understanding that when you have these institutional legacies, somebody has to step in to level the playing field. And even when the playing field is leveled, you get out of the first, you know, game in college, and then you go into a workforce that's still set up around white people and who you know and that sort of thing. These are systems that the three of us benefit from all the time, and we're at least cognizant of that fact, and we're not going to try to claim that we're being discriminated against or that there's reverse discrimination and reverse racism, because we understand that we and people who look like us still control all the political and economic levers of power in this country.
And before anybody comes at Bill with an email that says, here's a definition of discrimination in the dictionary, go read some critical race theory. There have been hundreds and hundreds of books that have been written by people of color about this that have more to say than the three-line definition that a bunch of white people put together in the dictionary. And then maybe you'll understand what we're talking about.
Right. And just, you know, one thing that Nate and I were discussing right before we started recording was this idea of people who say, well, I don't know someone, you know, I don't know someone of color, or I don't know, you know, someone who's gay, or I don't know a liberal, or I don't know whatever. Okay, you know what we have now? Google. As Greg said, there's so many things that have already been written. Don't go ask the first person or me to explain everything to you in the entire history of everything. Go do some research on your own.
Speaking of Google, I would encourage people to Google Louis C.K. white people. A very funny bit, basically, of Louis describing how if you don't recognize the privileges you get as being white, then you're just kind of an asshole. And it's hilarious, so I won't try to do it myself. But
all right. Any closing thoughts from anyone?
We were turned up.
All right. okay. I've been your host, Bill Humphrey. In studio with me, Nate. Thank you for being here again.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And on the line from Maryland, Greg. A lot of fun, as always.
Thank you, of course.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for February 24th, 2014. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, weekly and is usually available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear a repeat of it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Outside Delaware, you can stream it from WVUD.org at the same time. Special thanks to guest co-hosts Greg and Nate, and to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow Justin's work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.